This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk to Middle East expert Phyllis Bennis as Congress is poised to vote on the Iran nuclear deal.
It looks like Iran is not going to get nuclear weapons, although it never really wanted to. But the next question is, how about Israel getting rid of their 300 to 400 nuclear bombs?
As part of our special Lawyers You'll Like segment, we'll talk with attorney, activist, and publisher Bill Schapp.
Any of you ever wonder why there's a law against naming CIA agents? Well, it's aimed at Bill Schapp, or was at Bill Schapp and his friends.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Bogosian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Phyllis Bennis joins us today to talk about the Iran nuclear deal. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies and of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She's active in the United States and global Palestinian rights and peace movements, and her books include Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Policy, and Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer.
Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
I want to read a sentence from the U.S. Arms Control Association talking about the deal with Iran, said, quote, "The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action establishes a strong and effective formula for blocking all the pathways by which Iran could acquire material for nuclear weapons for more than a generation, and a verification system to promptly detect and deter possible efforts by Iran to covertly pursue nuclear weapons that will last indefinitely." Given this, Phyllis, why has there been really such ferocious opposition on the part of many U.S. senators?
Well, I think there's two reasons, and both of them are political. Neither have anything to do with what the agreement actually calls for. Before we say anything else, we should be clear that U.S. intelligence agencies, all 16 of them, are unified in their agreement that Iran is not trying to build a nuclear weapon. Iran does not have a nuclear weapon and is not making a nuclear weapon. So that's the starting point. You know, it's like, given that, why is this, you're asking exactly the right question, why is this such a nightmarish focus of U.S. war threats on one side and this desperate effort on the other side? So I think we have to look at it on the question of why is there such opposition. It's all political, and it comes from two directions. One, for three-quarters of the Republican Party, well, maybe that's unfair, I don't know the numbers, for some chunk of the Republican Party, anything that Barack Obama says yes to, they say no to. Anything that could remotely resemble a political victory for this president is something to be opposed at all cost, regardless of the consequences. If it undermines U.S. credibility as a diplomatic partner, doesn't matter. If it threatens the possibility of war in a very direct and real way, doesn't matter. The goal is anything Obama says yes, we say no. So for a bunch of Republicans, it's partisan, and it's exactly that. For a bunch of others, and there's certainly some overlap, but this is a much bigger grouping, and includes Democrats. This is a bipartisan part. The question is Israel, and Israel's supporters in the U.S. The Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, has made a career for the last 30 years or so of targeting Iran as posing some alleged existential danger to Israel. Now, in fact, it's Israel, not Iran, that has nuclear weapons. There is a nuclear weapons arsenal in the Middle East, but it belongs to Tel Aviv, not to Tehran. You wouldn't know that to listen to the sort of heated rhetoric that comes out of Israel and comes out of the United States. You would think that it's Israel that is somehow under threat, rather than every other country in the region. But the power of that campaign to portray Israel as this beleaguered country that is somehow threatened by Iran because of rhetorical There's no doubt that there is anti-Semitism in the Iranian leadership, and there was a president who was outrageous in his rhetoric about it. But the notion that when you look at actual strategic capacity, it's kind of nonsensical. The real threat, if Iran ever did decide to build a nuclear weapon, the real threat would be to Israel's nuclear monopoly, not to the existence of the State of Israel. So that's what I think has to be understood. But in that context, it has become impossible for those who live from donation to donation, who have to raise something like $50,000 every week to run for office every 2 years, which is the case for members of the House of Representatives, to ignore donors for whom not just protection of Israel, but somehow abiding by everything the Israeli prime minister says is the most important aspect of their political identity. So it becomes a really tricky business for people who may even recognize that, in fact, if your vantage point is, what do we do to protect Israel, this agreement actually does more than anything else might to protect Israel. But it's not, again, about the facts. It's about the politics. And the politics say, Israel's against this deal. It must be a bad deal, so we're against it. You know, there were tons of articles in the mainstream press about how difficult it was for Jewish members of Congress, which was somehow equated with being pro-Israel, which is a completely false equation because there's plenty of non-Jews who are as pro-Israel, uncritical of Israel, as any of the Jewish members, but how difficult it was for Jewish members of the Congress to figure out this vote when they wanted to support the president. Maybe they were Democrats, whatever, but they also had to deal with supporters and donors. You know, AIPAC, the main component of the pro-Israel lobby, not the only part, but the main part, put $40 million about a month ago into a 60-day campaign just to defeat the Iran deal. There are reports that it's been almost doubled since then, but they started with $40 million just for 60 days worth of advertising. And the glut of ads, those of you in New York have probably seen more even than we have here in D.C. because it was a time that members of Congress were in their districts, and you had things like the New York Times, a full-page ad solely focused on Cory Booker, you know, saying, Dear Senator Booker, don't do this. Israel's against it. Don't do this. It was extraordinary. You know, you read these things, and even for some of the articles and for some of the statements from different groups of former members of Congress and former this and former that, that came out in support of the deal, some of them were starting and ending with, this deal is good for Israel. And I kept thinking, why aren't they starting with, this deal is good for Americans? This deal is good for the world. This deal is good for Iranians. This deal is good for everybody in the region. But no, it was billed as, is this good for Israel or is this not good for Israel? And that became the linchpin of how the politics went forward. So between the question of Israel and the question of Obama, for those who live in the Washington bubble and don't recognize how that discourse has changed so profoundly in the last, say, 10 years, who really believe that criticizing Israel is somehow still political suicide, which it certainly is not, this became the political firestorm, and the substance was simply left behind.
Let me venture to criticize the United States, if I might.
You might.
We have a wonderful treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was designed to halt and then reverse the proliferation of nuclear weapons in the world. And how does the deal with Iran fit into the provisions of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, particularly the ones not only disallowing other countries from getting it, but then telling countries that have it to get rid of it? Can you put it in that context?
Yeah. You raised one of the most important parts of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Michael, and it's the part that never gets discussed in this country, which is that the Non-Proliferation Treaty isn't only about non-proliferation, it's also about disarmament. You know, if you look at the treaty, the key component of it in Article 4 basically says that everybody who signs on to this treaty, which is the vast majority of countries in the world, Israel, importantly, not being a signatory. Iran is a signatory. And the countries that sign on to it agree that they will never try to build a nuclear weapon or to get a nuclear weapon. And you would look at that and say, well, why would they ever sign on to that? And, you know, giving permission to at least the original five, quote, legal nuclear weapon states, the U.S., China, Russia, France, and England, why would all the other countries just agree that they never would while allowing these five to have those weapons? And the answer is twofold. They got two things out of it. One, they got the right to pursue peaceful nuclear programs, which is precisely what Iran and others have done. Now, do I think that's a good idea? No, I hate the idea that Iran and other countries have these massive nuclear power plants and all of that. But it is part of what they are guaranteed as signatories to the NPT. The other thing they get, which is in Article 6, is the agreement by those five nuclear weapons powers that they will move towards full nuclear disarmament. That's the part that nobody ever talks about. And this agreement with Iran certainly didn't talk about that. The agreement with Iran arguably violates Iran's rights as a signatory to the NPT, which guarantees it the right to pursue a nuclear power, a peaceful nuclear program, a nuclear power program, to enrich uranium, whatever. And the U.S. position is simply, well, we don't trust them, so it doesn't matter what the treaty says. And other countries have been willing to go along, and in this case, Iran was willing to sign on to it as well, where they don't lose all of their capacity to enrich uranium for peaceful power purposes, but they lose a bunch of it. They lose the vast majority of it, 98%, in fact. But the question of the limits of this agreement is a very important one. I think it is one of the advantages of this agreement is that it does set the stage for a potential future agreement for something that Iran and others led by Egypt have pushed for many years, which is a nuclear weapons-free zone throughout the Middle East. Now, ironically, the U.S. is also on record supporting that, although they never officially support it, but they drafted and signed a U.N. Security Council resolution back in 1991, the resolution that ended the first U.S. war against Iraq, included language that said in Article 14 of that resolution, Resolution 687, that supported the call for creation in the Middle East a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction. Period, full stop, no exceptions. No exception for Israel, no exception for anybody. And the U.S. signed on to that, and that's considered international law when it's a U.N. Security Council resolution. But when we asked State Department people about it at the time, saying, why did you draft this? You know, this isn't U.S. position. And they laughed it off and said, we knew nobody would ever take it seriously. And part of the problem is that even though we took it seriously, governments didn't take it seriously, and nobody held the U.S. to account for supporting what they said they supported in that resolution. So right now, the U.S. position is we stand with Israel. Israel says there will not be a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East until we decide that we want one, and we don't want one. And the U.S. says, as long as Israel says that, we say that too. And so there is no nuclear weapons-free zone. This deal, I think, sets the stage for some shifts, potentially even a shift on that question. Not immediately, but in the future, as the relationship between the United States and Iran changes, as there's a pullback from the kind of at-the-brink tensions between the U.S. and Iran, there's the basis for a whole different level of engagement between Washington and Tehran that could include the kind of grand bargain that Iran offered back in 2001. There's the potential for negotiations over ending the war in Syria, and there's potential for the possibility, at least, of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East.
But, you know, then there's also the potential for the United States to come to grips with the fact that Iran supports Hamas, which was elected, and Iran supports Hezbollah in Lebanon, which was an elected government. The United States rails against Iran, but the fact is that those are two democratically elected governments, the only ones in the Arab countries. But that might if there's a more of a rapprochement with Iran, they may stop pointing that out. And in the meantime, what would Israel do? So I think what you're laying out here, Phyllis, is that the strains on the American relationship with Israel, those could grow even stronger. Wouldn't you agree?
I do agree. I think that the agreement has enormous potential for changing how the U.S. is perceived and how it operates in the Middle East. And that becomes very important, I think. Now, there's no guarantees here. There are no guarantees. We don't know that the U.S. will shift at all. There's a serious danger, and I've been writing about this for months now. There's a serious danger that with this agreement going forward, that the U.S. will feel compelled to provide even more consolation prizes, if you will, to Israel to compensate for what is being perceived as an Israeli loss politically on this battle. They already have moved, and these negotiations were underway before this agreement was signed, so it's not directly related, but it's certainly moved it forward. There's already negotiations underway to raise the current level of U.S. military aid to Israel, which was a $30 billion package straight to the Israeli military over 10 years, to raise that to $47 billion for the next 10 years, which would raise the annual gift of U.S. taxpayer money from just over $3 billion a year to $4.7 billion a year. It's a huge increase. Now, we also know that President Obama in the past has indicated that perhaps he would be willing to reconsider the consistent U.S. protection of Israel in the United Nations that prevents Israel from being held accountable for potential war crimes. Now, whether he will maintain that and make good on that indication, it wasn't a commitment, it was perhaps we'll examine this, we'll see whether that goes forward. But certainly the deal has the potential to shake up what has been kind of taken for granted as the basis of the U.S.-Israeli relationship.
Phyllis, Noam Chomsky, in an article titled "The Iranian Threat, Who is the Gravest Danger to World Peace," has a line talking about who then would be concerned by an Iranian deterrent? And he answers that the rogue states that rampage in the region and do not want to tolerate any impediment to their reliance on aggression and violence in the lead in this regard are the U.S. and Israel. Can you comment on that?
You know, I think right now one of the ironies is that in the wars that are ravaging the Middle East, starting with the multifaceted Syrian war, which is really no longer a civil war, but is at least 8 separate wars being waged in Syria, Iran and the U.S. are on the same side in a number of aspects of that war, most particularly in Iraq, which is one of the two centerpieces of that war. The U.S. and Iran are both the major backers of the government in Baghdad, the government that the U.S. installed and pays and arms, is arguably more accountable to Iran than it is to the United States. It's Iranian-trained and Iranian-armed militias that have managed the few victories over ISIS that have taken place in Iraq, and the U.S. doesn't like to talk about that, but unofficially acknowledges it and, in fact, deals directly with Iranian military people in ways to make sure that they don't get in each other's way, as the State Department likes to describe it. They don't want to acknowledge it, but they don't want to undermine the fact that the Iranian-trained militias are far stronger and have more credibility in the country than the U.S.-backed government-run military. They are also among the most sectarian forces as well. So it's a hugely complicated relationship, but it's certainly one in which the Iranians being on the right side relative to U.S. opinion, you know, to U.S. official opinion, makes things very complicated when the U.S. tries to say that Iran is, you know, is a major problem in the Middle East. Well, you can say that, but they're supporting the same side that you are, so you better be a little bit careful. In Syria, of course, you have a more direct challenge where you have Iran backing the Syrian regime. But even that right now seems to be under some reconsideration, both in Moscow and Tehran, which are the major backers of the Assad regime. Whether that's a regime that's viable seems to be a question that's being rethought, if you will, in both those capitals. So a lot of things right now are changing. There's already been some direct negotiations, direct diplomacy involving the U.S., Russia, and Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia being Iran's primary regional challenger as a regional power. So, you know, you have this set of changing relations in the region, and again, the potential for this nuclear deal is that the longstanding, unwavering opposition from the U.S. towards Iran, to the degree that it shifts, it opens up a lot of new possibilities for new relationships across the region. And hopefully, the most optimistic thing that I see in the medium term, not in the short term, but not in the very long term either, in the medium term, is the possibility of serious new negotiations that would involve Iran at the table over how to resolve the Syrian war.
Coming back to political forces in the United States, the personalities and political types like the neocons and the liberal interventionists who supported the war against Iraq, it's dismaying to see that these are the same forces here that were opposing the deal with Iran and talking about war with Iran. How do you see the Obama victory as affecting these forces?
Well, I think that it's likely to have a at least short-term quieting effect on some of the liberal interventionists, but they have not been the leading force this time around on the Iran side of things. Some of them have had their voice in there, but they have not been the leading force. The leading force really has been from the old neocon leadership. Dick Cheney is scheduled to give a major speech next week, next Tuesday morning, at the American Enterprise Institute.
You can't put a good man down. It's amazing, isn't it?
Oh. I think what we're seeing is that the hardcore neocons, led, ironically enough, by Dick Cheney himself, who's making a comeback, giving a major speech at the American Enterprise Institute Tuesday morning, are the ones that are pushing most directly for war as the alternative. The most overt call, of course, has come from John Bolton, who was Bush's temporary UN ambassador, the same guy who once said, "There is no United Nations. You could cut off the top 10 floors of UN headquarters and no one would know the difference." This was a man sent to be the U.S. ambassador to the UN. You know, those are the people who are leading it along with the supporters of Israel. So you have that combination of political forces united around militarizing the U.S. relationship with Iran and expanding massively the existing region-wide war, which is already driving, we now are seeing hundreds of thousands of people every month, 300,000 to 400,000 people being driven out of the region into Europe by the level of fighting. And all of this is rooted, of course, in the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. It's what gave rise to ISIS. It's what gave given rise to this entire crisis going on in the Middle East. So in that context, you know, you have this, the supporters of the war in Iraq, I don't know that they actually believe that there's a victory there somehow, except, of course, they say that the reason for ISIS rising is not the facts, which is that ISIS rose as originally part of the opposition to the U.S. occupation, but rather that ISIS somehow emerged because of the withdrawal of U.S. troops, sort of just turning it on its head. And unfortunately, a lot of people seem to believe that. So there's a huge level of education that needs to go forward about why these wars are going on, what the threat of war with Iran actually would mean. And the crucial thing is, do people in Congress get it? Do people in the Senate get it? Do the American people get it? The media doesn't seem to get it. It's hugely problematic that we have these people who were responsible for this enormous catastrophe, which is the consequences of the U.S. war in Iraq, are still being invited back as educated pundits, as you know, those with experience to speak to the American people, to be the talking heads on every major television network, to explain why there are such dangers from Iran, why the military option must remain, quote, on the table. You know, it's an outrage that they are not, it's an outrage that they are not on trial in The Hague for war crimes. But if not that, you know, the fact that they're allowed to walk free among us and then be put forward as if they are the real experts, this is a pretty outrageous reality.
Phyllis, it is outrageous, but our answer to that is to have you on, and it's been just a pleasure to have you. We're also looking forward to reading your new book, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, and we'd love to have you back in the next few weeks to talk about that.
Well, I look forward to it.
Thanks so much for this update.
Thank you, Phyllis.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Several weeks ago, we spoke about the recently departed courageous journalist Ellen Ray, who in a way prefigured WikiLeaks and Julian Assange in the days before the widespread use of computers in exposing the CIA and its crimes. Today, we speak with her companion, Bill Schaap, who along with Ellen Ray edited the Covert Action Information Bulletin for some 27 years. Attorney Bill Schaap graduated from law school at the University of Chicago in 1964, and has been practicing law ever since. Bill specialized in military law initially, practicing in both Okinawa and then in Germany. He later became the editor-in-chief of the Military Law Reporter in Washington for a number of years. In the 70s and 80s, he was staff counsel at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. In the late 80s, he was an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, where he taught courses on propaganda and disinformation. In addition to being a practicing lawyer, Bill was a journalist, publisher, and a writer specializing in intelligence as it relates to the media. He was the co-publisher of the great magazine Covert Action Quarterly for more than 20 years. He also published a magazine on propaganda and disinformation called Lies of Our Times. Bill Schaap has written many articles and edited a number of books on the topic of media and intelligence. He joins us today on Lawyers You'll Like to discuss his work as a lawyer and a writer. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder. Attorney Bill Schaap, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Bill, how does a high school guy from Freeport, Long Island, who goes to the University of Chicago and gets a job at a Wall Street firm, how does he end up doing movement political work? What was it that got you started on the that road?
Well, it was fairly quick and fairly direct. One of the first big cases I worked on at this Wall Street firm, they had some outside counsel working on it, one of whom was Dave Lubell. And Dave Lubell, who had, I think, been a recruiter for the Communist Party in his youth, was always good at spotting somebody who might be worth recruiting, and he started to tell me that there was a convention of this lawyers group coming up. And I said, I really don't like lawyers groups. And he said, you'll like this one. And it was the 1967 Lawyers Guild Convention in New York. He dragged me to one event, and I met Bill Kunstler, I met Arthur Kanoy, and I met Victor Rabinowitz and all the old-timers. And I'd been on Wall Street for a year or two. I said, I didn't even know there were lawyers like this. So I joined the same day, met Bernardine Dorn, and a few weeks later, she called me and said, we need your help. And I said, what do you need my help for? She said, you got to defend a bunch of Columbia students. And I said, what'd they do? She said, well, they're protesting a gymnasium. They're trying to tear down the fence. I said, what's wrong with a gymnasium? She said, you don't understand. I'll explain it to you. So, of course, Columbia was taking over half of Morningside Park, trying to turn it into a Columbia student gymnasium, not a people's gymnasium. The next thing I knew, the whole riot started at Columbia. And she said, as soon as they start arresting people, you're going to have to go down and defend them. And I said, I've never done that. And she said, it'll be very easy. And shortly before the arrests happened, I went to the December 10th dinner, I guess it was ECLC.
That's the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee.
So I was sitting at a
table.
And
they were set up in part because the ACLU would not defend the Communist Party.
That's
and
right.
Dissidents in the Communist
Leonard
Party.
Leonard Boudin was their chief counsel.
Yeah. So I went, this was my first legal political thing I went to, and I was sitting at a table with Bill Kunstler and Arthur Kanoy and Victor Rabinowitz and a few other people like that. And somebody comes rushing in and says, we just got a phone call. A bunch of people got busted at a demonstration protesting a speech by Hubert Humphrey. He was Lyndon Johnson's vice president, and he was thinking of running for president.
And he supported the war against the Vietnamese.
He was everything bad about the word liberal is what he was. He was a liberal warmonger. So in any event, they went around the table, and all of a sudden I noticed everybody's looking at me. Because Kunstler, it was 11 o'clock at night. Kunstler didn't want to run down to night court, and Kanoy didn't want to run down to night court. And I'm like the youngest one at the table, and I've been practicing law for a couple of years. And they said, go on, do it. And I said, I don't even know what an arraignment is. And Kunstler said, it's easy. Let me tell you, go down there. The first thing you do is make friends with the clerk. Because if you're ever doing criminal law, make friends with the clerk. Go in the back, fill out all the little notices in advance, sign your name on 50 pieces of paper, and give them to him. So I go there. All these people got arrested protesting a speech by Hubert Humphrey. And I'm looking at the list, and one of the people on this list of like 30 or 40 defendants was Paul Krasner, who was sort of a friend I knew from before. I said, oh, boy, because I looked into the audience, and there were like 200 people there, and it's midnight. And I said, what the 200? Well, how many? And they were almost all of them were Krasner's friends. The word had gotten out that he'd been busted. He was in jail. And
Krasner at the time was the editor of the great magazine, The Realist.
The Realist,
which was a political satire magazine.
Very, very well known and very clever, smart guy. So I said, hope he doesn't come to way near the end. I've never done this before. And then they call the first case, and it's Krasner. And he comes up there, and everybody in the audience jumps up and starts screaming and yelling and cheering. And the judge says, clear the courtroom, get rid of them all, get them all out of here. And there were about seven or eight elderly black women in the back row who were there for their sons or husbands or whatever, who were just ordinary criminal cases. And they said, not us, Your Honor. We don't know this guy. We don't have anything to do with him. And he said, all right, the old ladies in the back row can stay. Everybody else get out of the courtroom. And so they call the first case, and it's Paul, and he's standing next to me. And he said, I'm going to get life. And I said, no, it's disorderly conduct. I don't think you're going to get life. And I said, what happened? He said, well, they told me I could have not been arrested if I said I was there as a journalist, but I, out of solidarity, I refused to do that. So I came up with everybody. He said, but I had a big problem with the arresting officer who's really wants to throw the book at me. I said, why is that? He said, well, they have this new thing now. Since at mass arrests, one officer would be assigned like 30 or 40 people, and he'd never remember who was who. And when you'd go in for a first court appearance, you'd keep your client back sitting with like five other people and say, all right, officer, so which one of them is the guy you arrested?
and he would have no idea. So they started taking Polaroid pictures of the arresting officer standing next to the defendant, so he'd have them with him in his pocket to look and make sure he knew. And Paul said, so when they put us together for the Polaroid picture, I turned to the guy and said, where are we going after the prom, sweetie? And he said, and the guy went ballistic. So we're talking to Bill Schaap, lawyers you'll like. Bill is talking about his beginnings as a movement lawyer in the 60s. We just talked about Paul Krasner, political satirist that Bill was defending in court.
Okay, so Bill, eventually you ended up going to Okinawa defending soldiers in the anti-war movement, and then also, I think, in Germany. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was I was hanging out at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I was there one afternoon, and we had just decided that morning that Lubell, Fine & Schaap was going to fold.
That was the law firm you went to after Wall Street.
Right, and we discovered that having no paying clients would lead to bankruptcy. Sure as... So I said, what am I going to do? And I hear a voice from over a cubicle, and it was Greg Finger. He said, you want to go to Okinawa?
Greg Finger was, I think, at that time, administrative director right. of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I said, well, I'm open for anything. I said, this is for me and Ellen? She said, yeah, we got jobs for both of you. And the next thing I know, a few days later, I was signed up to be a staff counsel on the Lawyers Guild project, military law project in Okinawa.
And Ellen Ray, of course, is your companion, and you and Ellen,
she was
head out to the east.
She was quickly nicknamed Della Street by the military judges. And we spent the next 3 years, 4 years, doing military law all over the world. That was what got us really interested in international stuff. When we first went over there, we didn't even know what the CIA was, and most people in America didn't know what the CIA was. We're talking like 71, 72. This is long before the Church Committee reports, or several years. And when you work overseas in that kind of a climate with the military, and you learn a lot fast about American imperialism. And then once you learn that, you learn about the CIA. And that led us to, when we finally got back, deciding to work on originally on Counter Spy magazine and then on Covert Action magazine.
I was a subscriber to Covert Action Quarterly, as was Michael Ratner, a great magazine. What was the purpose of the magazine? Because now you're wearing a journalist editor hat. And what did you try to accomplish with the magazine?
Let's just note that Bill was co-publisher of Covert Action for nearly 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. We started it on a shoestring, and the original purpose was just to expose the CIA. We worked with Lou Wolf, who was an expert at uncovering CIA agents in U.S. embassies, not through any classified documents, but because if you knew how to read the paperwork and State Department things, you could tell who were the ringers, and you knew these people were CIA. And we were so successful that Congress passed a law against us.
Let's stay up. Let's go too fast, because the magazine, it was a really famous and well-known magazine, and there's still people who look at it as this is the highest level of American journalism, what this magazine was doing. And there was a number of years when there were actually incredible lists of CIA people who were disrupting the politics of other countries that you guys published. So talk about that for a minute as to what your goal was, and then the struggle over when they tried to outlaw you.
Yeah, our goal really was to try and make these people ineffective, because the only way most CIA case officers could work, particularly the ones that were assigned to an embassy, was to have to pretend to be something else. They were all, you know, third assistant political secretaries, second assistant, whatever, and those were all phony things. And their job was to inveigle their way into various community organizations in whatever foreign capital they might have been posted, to recruit people to turn against their own countries, be traitors to their own countries, and become spies for the U.S. So we thought that if we identify these people beforehand, it might make their job a little harder, which it did. Of course, the problem was the government said we were trying to get them killed, which we weren't trying to do, and nobody we exposed ever did get killed. But they were very fortunate that one CIA station chief in Athens named Richard Welch was exposed by a Greek group and assassinated. And for a long time, everybody, including President Gerald Ford, tried to say that he got assassinated because we exposed him. And in fact, we hadn't. We later, with the help of Mort Halpern, who had connections to the State Department, discovered cables where Welch had been warned not to move into his predecessor's house in Athens because everybody in Athens knew that was where the CIA chief of station lived. And we found a cable he sent back, said, "I'm sorry, my wife really likes the house. We're going to move in." And they moved in, and like 3 days later, he was gunned down on the front steps.
Now, they tried to pin that on you guys for a long time.
They did. Well, Gerald Ford said it directly.
It's still, when you read stuff, it's still like one of the incidents they point to. There's someone you haven't mentioned yet. I'm interested in what his role was. And Phil Agee is dead now, but he published a book called Inside the Company, which exposed the names of hundreds of agents subverting democracy and unionization in Latin America and Central America. Now, he had some relationship to the magazine, or?
No, we founded it with him. He had been an advisor to Counterspy. Counterspy folded when Welch got killed because of the pressure was too much, and we started the new one called Covert Action, and we worked with Phil directly the whole time. He was not the person who was discovering who the undercover people were. Lew Wolfe was doing that. But Phil wrote articles for us in every issue, and we worked very closely with him. And in fact, some of us traveled around the world when he was asked to go to various places to try to expose CIA operations, the most well-known being Jamaica, when the CIA was trying to overthrow the government of Michael Manley. And the government asked Phil Agee to come down and help, and Phil asked Ellen Ray to come down and help him help them. And once you start exposing these things, they really don't have any defense.
Were you harassed yourself, and was Covert Action infiltrated or attempts to close the paper down, the magazine down?
So far as we know, we weren't infiltrated because it was just the three of us. We didn't have a big. We did everything. I mean, we waxed the galleys. We rolled them down with them. We did everything. So they couldn't actually infiltrate the organization, but they certainly did try to catch us in something phony. We would get tips that turned out to be CIA trying to get us to print some story that wasn't true, so they could then discredit us. No, we actually had more direct interference from the government when we were doing the military law work before Covert Action. The military is always a bit more heavy-handed than the CIA, and they would plant bugs in our attic and in Okinawa and things like that. But they didn't know we were very close to a lot of MPs, and they used to bring us the transcripts and show us that they were recording everything that was going on at the legal counseling. And I ended up getting 100 court-martial convictions thrown out because they were eavesdropping the defense attorney. And if you prove the defense attorney was being eavesdropped, you won the case.
One more question on the magazine, Bill. There was a point where after you'd published the names of CIA agents for many years, that they passed a law. It was really, you would have to call it the Covert Action Information Bulletin Law, because it was passed to stop your work, which was all taken from public sources. So tell us what that law is and what's been its sort of history as we've gone forward.
It's only been used a few times. It was... it's called the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, and there are two parts. One makes it a crime for someone who is in the government, has classified information, to reveal someone's identity. But the second part makes it a crime to reveal the identity of someone that you did not learn from classified information or from your position. But if, and this was the tricky, they put in word, but if you were in the business of exposing these kind of people, and... We actually, at one point, Floyd Abrams had gone down to Washington on behalf of AP, CBS, and the New York Times to protest the law. And then he came back and he said, "Nobody has to worry. They're only interested in getting Covert Action magazine." And I said, "Thanks a lot, Floyd."
I want to address that for a second because it's a really interesting point. What happened is the argument that was made is if you use these in a legitimate way, like you're exposing one agent who... may have eavesdropped on somebody or murdered somebody, then a newspaper could do that. But if it was the business, quote, the business or the work of the magazine to expose agents in general, although there were always a purpose for Covert Action doing it, then it violated the law. And they sold that to the Congress and they passed that law. And what the effect has been, from my looking at this, is Michael Ratner speaking, is even, quote, magazines that
only are going to publish one name about what an agent's doing in Haiti or somewhere else are completely nervous about it and don't do it. So the law has had what we lawyers call a chilling effect. So you actually don't publish the names, not you personally, but magazines don't publish them. And now what it makes me think of is this new law. They're developing a shield law for journalists. And there's what they call an Assange exception. It's going to protect journalists as long as the journal or the publisher doesn't have as its main business publishing classified or confidential documents.
Right, that's the same the
same
theory.
Idea. It won't protect people like WikiLeaks, but it will protect the New York Times.
Yeah.
So as if there's legitimate publishers and illegitimate publishers somehow,
and
according
to
their policy.
They decide which is
and
which.
And they and a judge will decide. So so what happens is no one takes a risk after that.
Yeah, it's very, very rare. I mean, you will see it on occasion, but usually only if something else has been. I mean, the whole thing with Valerie Plame, only after that was all over the place. I mean, in the beginning, even the New York Times and other papers wouldn't say the name of this person. But once that person's name was in 100 magazines and 10 television shows, they started naming it. But the law itself was, it's only been used once or twice. Once was in the Plame case, and once, which is very not well known, was a Bill Kunstler case of a Native American Marine embassy guard who had told somebody who turned out to be a Russian spy, I think, who a couple of the CIA people at the that particular embassy were. And it's a very hard case to find because it was a court-martial. It wasn't a federal court case. It was a court-martial. But the charge against him in the court-martial was violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Law. But those, as far as we know, are the only two times it's ever been used.
But the reason it's been used so rarely is because no one's publishing the names of CIA agents anymore.
Right, right.
So it's a big problem.
Bill, you published a book long before I ever met you, a book that I bought and read and cherished about Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans, who investigated the Kennedy assassination. Tell us what was behind that, because it was quite an extraordinary thing when you published that book.
Yeah, it was mostly due to the fact that Ellen Ray had known Jim back when he was investigating Clay Shaw, and she had actually gone down to New Orleans in 67 and 68 and been one of his clack of supporters. But then we got a call from Mary Howell, the guild lawyer in New Orleans. She was a friend of Jim Garrison's, and she said he had a manuscript, and he had a publisher, but the publisher had rejected it. They thought it was a little too outré. And we went down to meet with him, and Ellen said, "Oh, Jim Garrison, my idol, I'd love." And the problem was that he had written the book in the third person, and it was obvious that the book should be written in the first person. So we had to go out. We hired Zach Sklar, who was a great editor at the time, and we redid the book, and it became JFK, and it was a bestseller. And we were in Havana. He doesn't admit this, Oliver Stone, but we met him in Havana.
Yeah, I heard that during Ellen cornered him in an elevator.
Right, during the film festival, and she said, "Have I got a property for you?" Because we knew he was an assassination freak, and we gave him an advance copy of the book. And like that same night, he called and said, "It's really very interesting. I can't do anything with it, but it's really very interesting." And the next day he called and said, "Listen, it's really very interesting. Don't sell it to anybody else." And then the third day he called and said, "I want to buy it, but you have to keep it top secret until I do the film," which we did, and he made a hell of a film.
You published a newsletter called Lies of Our Times, and it was aimed at the newspaper that prints everything that's fit, the New York Times. But more generally, it was devised to expose government disinformation and propaganda. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, that was in the 80s or 90s, Bill?
It was in the 90s, from 1990 to 1995, I think. We did 6 years of it. It was, to a certain extent, the abuses we were crying about got a little bit less over time, because that sometimes is the helpful result of this kind of exposure. But we were just tired with people thinking that if it was in the New York Times, it must be true, or if Dan Rather said it, it must be true, or whatever. And the fact is, those people lie all the time. If it suits their people's needs. So we had a great run. We had Noam Chomsky did a regular column every issue for us, and we had a lot of really good writers from all over the world, mostly from the States, explaining how stories that had become gospel were really completely untrue.
Bill, you've taught courses on propaganda and disinformation at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and you've been in the field for decades. How do you comment on the American people's response to recent revelations of the ubiquitous surveillance state and really a secret government? Have things changed for the better or the worse in terms of public awareness and response?
I think they've changed a bit for the better. We're still way behind Europe, where the average European is skeptical of anything its government says, and that's not so much the case here. But I think we've gotten to a point where people recognize that the government lies to them. They recognize that there's an awful lot that goes on that they don't know very much about. It's a big step up from in the 60s and 70s. Most Americans had no idea what was good. They didn't know what the NSA was. The NSA was secret. They barely knew what the CIA was. And they had no idea that all that stuff was going on. Nor did they have any notion of the degree to which the government had influence in the media, particularly the foreign media. I mean, that was one of the CIA's best operations, was to control journalists all over the world, including American journalists. But sometimes you didn't even have to, because you could plant a story with an agent in Germany, and then Reuters would pick it up, and then AP would pick it up, and then the story that the CIA guy wrote would be in the front page of the American papers, without anybody publishing it being aware of that.
Bill, you started the Institute for Media Analysis to try to give a boost to people that were doing the kind of thing that you and Ellen had been doing all those years. Tell us about that.
Well, we set up, we actually got nonprofit tax-exempt status fairly quickly, which was a little bit surprising. Mel Wolf was representing us at the time. I didn't want to represent myself. And originally, the government tried to deny the application, and they sent him a letter saying, what political party does Ed Herman belong to? What political party does Bill Shapp and Ellen Ray belong to? And he sent them back this scathing thing as the director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, blah, 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 blah. And they just backed off and immediately granted it. Now, it's funny because there's all this talk going on now about the Obama administration and the IRS vamping on the Tea Party organizations that want to get tax exemption. Well, in the Reagan years, and the IRS was vamping on the left-wing groups exactly the same. I mean, it's the notion that the IRS is completely divorced from the administration power is nonsense. There may be a few Korea people, but a lot of people come in each time there's a new administration who think the way that administration thinks. But anyway, Mel's letter did the trick, and we got the tax exemption. And then we started, we were publishing pamphlets in the beginning that people were writing for us. Some by Phil Agee. We did one by Edgar Chamorro about the role of the CIA and the Contras in Nicaragua. One by Carl Ginsburg about the Moynihan Report and racism. And then we started the magazine and The Lies of Our Times, and we started doing books. We actually published half a dozen books, although book publishing is much harder than magazine publishing. It's a much bigger investment. And since we were, by definition, not publishing things that we expected to be bestsellers, it was a little risky to begin with.
There were a couple of books I remember. They were great. One was, and I think the first one you did, was called White Paper, White Wash.
Right.
And it was by Phil Agee. And at that time, the U.S. government had issued a series of documents trying to show, was it Cuban or Russian support for the El Salvador insurgents, the revolutionaries. And Phil just... What did he do?
Well, he just he went through it and he showed how every one of these things were a lie and some of the documents were forgeries. The whole white paper was a scam. It wasn't very often that the government would stick its neck out like that and publish a white paper, particularly when it was filled with lies and forgeries, but they didn't realize that Phil was gonna expose it like that. And then we started doing a bunch of books. We published Ralph McGehee's book about his 25 years in the CIA. It was at a certain point, it was fairly easy to get. We referred to all these people as formers. And formers were getting in touch with us every day. And unfortunately, some of them had very bad manuscripts, but a few had good manuscripts. And so we spent quite a few years publishing as much as we could. I mean, it started to get less important in the sense that the American people were learning more and more about it. After... By the 80s, into the 90s, it was not shocking to people, or at least to average Americans, to learn about these kind of things. In the beginning, it really was. In the beginning, the American people had no idea what was going on.
There's still a lot of formers coming to the fore. Ray McGovern comes to mind, that people who have worked in the inside. McGovern was debriefing George Bush Sr.
Yeah. And Snowden is certainly, Snowden's we would call,
another
a former.
Example. Yeah.
And he, I mean, he's doing it big time. He's like Assange and WikiLeaks. I mean, when you can do something on that scale, it dwarfs what we were able to do in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, but you guys were really the pioneers at that point. My gosh.
One of the greatest things about even the naming names columns and stuff is that we were doing this stuff and we didn't get killed. And that was a very helpful example for other people, because people constantly would ask us, how come you haven't been assassinated?
I forgot the column is called Naming Names.
Right. And Phil would say, you know, I don't think they want to make martyrs out of us. Because people always ask Phil Agee why the CIA hadn't assassinated him.
And he couldn't live here, though. He had to go live in Cuba.
Well, for a long time. But we also discovered when Mel was doing Freedom of Information.
That's Mel Wolf, who's a former legal director for the ACLU.
Yeah, he did Phil's Freedom of Information Act, and we discovered documents that at least showed that there was a big CIA Justice Department meeting about assassinating him. And it was then sort of covered up, and it came out stuck in a bunch of FOIA stuff. And we went to the judge in the case to try and get more, because these were obviously got in there by accident. The judge said, I'm going to look at this stuff in camera. And after he looked at it in camera, he said, well, I've looked at it and you ain't going to get it.
You know, when we think about that, and we'll, it would surprise me if they hadn't at least had that kind of meeting about Ed Snowden, whether he should be killed. I think they probably came out, well, he shouldn't be, for one, for maybe political reasons, but also because there may be stuff that he's given to other people all over the world and that they don't have access to.
I wanted to ask Bill what advice you would have for young attorneys considering a progressive practice who may be frightened by government tactics.
The fact of the matter is that you, as we know from Lawyers Guild people all over the country, you can be a politically active, politically conscious lawyer and still make a living. You know, you're not going to be like a Wall Street tycoon, but there are a large chunk of the American people who are progressive, and most of them, when they have legal stuff, they'd rather have a progressive lawyer. It doesn't mean you have to defend them against some, you know, big criminal case. I mean, progressive people want a progressive lawyer to do their will or buy their house or do their whatever. And I don't necessarily encourage progressives to become lawyers, but I do encourage lawyers to become progressives.
On that note, Bill, it's been an astounding career. I mean, it really taking on the state, imperialism, the CIA, and one that had plenty of risks with it. So thank you from all of us.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on Law & Disorder. You are truly a lawyer you'll like.
Thanks.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.